The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Everybody saw what happened today. I don't think we have to do any explaining. I'm not allowed to anyway, because this judge is corrupt. He's a corrupt judge. This judge, what he did and what his ruling was, is a disgrace. Everybody saw what happened today. He's a corrupt judge and he's totally conflicted. And I got to get back on the campaign trail. I'm not supposed to be here. We are so innocent. There's never been anything like it. Read every single analyst, legal analyst. I'm innocent, and I'm being held in this court with a corrupt judge who's totally conflicted. Take a look at his conflict. It's a disgrace to the city of New York, to the state of New York, and to the country.
I agree with you. He was furious after court and was furious before he even got into court. He said something that I thought was very significant. All they think about, Biden's fanatical left, is arresting and killing their opponent. Now, he's never used the word killing before, and I thought that was Donald Trump laying down a marker. Because remember the first term. Madonna, let's blow up the White House. Johnny Depp, poison him. Kathy Griffin, behead him. Snoop Dogg, cap to the skull. It was a very hostile time in American history. And sometimes we forget about that, and you can almost feel it boiling back up again. Last night, Jen Psaki mentioned Trump dying. The constant repetition of the propaganda of that we need to save democracy from a genocidal Nazi dictator. Joe Biden, just the other day, said that Donald Trump is going to get back into office and seek vengeance on all of Democrats. That is just enough for an unhinged man to come up and try to be the hero and try to save the country. So that word, I thought, was a powerful, calculated word that he used today.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little color about what it's really like?
You know, you walk in and it's really actually something surreal. You feel like you're in the Twilight Zone. Today, I walked in and the first person that caught my eye was everybody from Greg Kelly on the right to George Conway on the left, Caitlin Collins sitting there. And, you know, I appreciate that they all want to act journalistic in those moments. I'm sitting there and I'm looking, but they're snarking and it's very strange feeling.
So it's like a show trial.
It is.
For the media.
Right.
Except there's no law that's been broken. They haven't even named the crime.
It's unbelievable. And when anything salacious happens, all you hear is the clicking of, you know, the keyboards. But when actual law and facts are discussed, it's silent.
That I expect that. Yeah. That sums it up perfectly. Everyone's looking at Donald Trump. Is he cursing? Is he sleeping? What else can you see when you're inside that room?
The ruin of our justice system, to be honest.
A ruined justice system. The show trial continues in Manhattan. And as you heard from President Trump himself, it's keeping him off the campaign trail. That said, he's making plans to campaign in New Jersey. He thinks the blue state of New Jersey is in play. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. Can't believe it's already the last show of the work week. Friday is upon us. The live stream of this show, it appears every day, every weekday, I should say, at 11:05 a.m. in the central time zone of the United States. It's at trumpetdaily.com or at the Rumble channel. Just go to rumble.com/Trumpet Daily. As we noted on yesterday's show, though, even with the circus continuing, even with the show trial continuing, these corrupt judges, these corrupt prosecutors, and then the reporters for their part, as was just noted there, they're just in there to hear the salacious gossip. They don't care about the facts of the case. As Jesse noted, there's no crime. There isn't even a crime that's been spelled out. But put Stormy Daniels on the stand and let her bring up all of these seedy, salacious details of a relationship that probably never even happened. And that really gets them going on the keyboards. It's a spectacle. As I said yesterday, though, a lot with respect to the lawfare. It's unraveling on the radical left. Kim Strassel makes this point at Wall Street Journal. It says, little, in short, is going as planned. She says the lawfare strategy from the start, pile on Mr. Trump in a way that ensured Republicans would rally for his nomination, then use legal proceedings to crush his ability to campaign, drain his resources, and make him too toxic or isolated in prison to win a general election. He won the nomination, but the effort against him is flailing, courtesy of an echo chamber of anti-Trump prosecutors and journalists who continue to indulge the fantasy that every court, judge, jury, and timeline exists to dance to their partisan favor. And then when it doesn't, they're just shocked. And they go after the judge in Florida, Judge Cannon. She must be all in on MAGA because she's exposing how corrupt the DOJ is. It says these own goals are striking. Mr. Smith wouldn't be facing delays if he'd acknowledged up front the important constitutional question of presidential immunity. So they made a lot of mistakes. And as Trump often points out, I mean, if these charges were legit, they could have come forward with this in 2021, 2022. As it is, they waited until deep into 2023, and then they started demanding that judges accelerate the process through the campaigning, as it happens, of 2024. Sundance at Conservative Treehouse, he mentioned that Senator Rick Scott, he was on the front row of the courtroom yesterday in a show of support for Donald Trump. There's a few that are beginning to speak up. They know that this judge, he's issued this unconstitutional gag order so that President Trump has to be very measured in what he says. Even still, he can kind of sound off from one day to the next. But anyway, there's Rick Scott in the courtroom. Sundance says here he was seated in the front row of the courtroom gallery to show his support for Trump in New York City. It says many of President Trump's supporters in politics understand he is under a gag order and unable to speak in his own defense. It's good to see those who understand the dynamic show up in New York and say things that President Trump cannot. It says in his media remarks, the former Florida governor and current Senator Rick Scott outlined the background of the key participants who are targeting Trump via these ridiculous political lawfare tactics. It says strong and truthful remarks by Senator Scott. We need more. We need more than just him. I mean, he's got his few defenders in the media, as you heard there in the cold open. But what an attack. I mean, and it's so audacious and so obvious. America's under attack. These same people that say if Trump gets back in there, he may go after his opponents, his political opponents. Total lack of self-awareness. You know, Trump said this is bad for America, but he also noted how bad this is for New York City. New York City, this was at City Journal. Just all the resources and the time that New York City is putting into this show trial. Says here, as former President Donald Trump's trial continues in a Manhattan criminal court, many anticipate that it will be both historic and salacious, and it seems to be delivering on both counts. It says one of the greatest costs involves security. While New York apparently lacks the resources to police its streets, security for this hush money trial will cost the city $50,000 per day. $50,000. Ramped up security for the trial includes road closures, a frozen perimeter, I don't even know the names of all this equipment. Further on, it says Trump's trial will also be time consuming. Some estimate that it will run from 6 to 8 weeks of embarrassing evidence. It has that in quotes. This stands in stark contrast to the many New York criminal cases summarily plea bargained out of 18,478 cases, 15,000 were plea bargained. In 2019, 96% of New York's felony convictions and 99% of misdemeanor convictions stem from guilty pleas. But this one, no, this has to drag out. You got to get Stormy on the stand to dig up the dirt, to tell more lies. She's already been on record saying that she was lying initially. It says here, it's indefensible that New York is devoting so much time and expense to the Trump trial, even as dangerous crimes go unprosecuted. Criminals roam the streets with little fear of facing jail time. Manhattan's crime clearance rate is an abysmal 29.8%. In 2019, New York's 104,000 felony arrests resulted in only 5,000 prison sentences. Out of 105,000, they put 5,000 behind bars. And so crime is just rampant. And here, all these resources, they go toward Get Trump. Richard Palmer had a paragraph in this morning's Trumpet Brief about the UCLA police investigation into the protests that took place on their campus. It's, according to this paragraph from Richard, it's one of the largest UCLA Police Department investigations in history. And guess who they're going after? The Hamas supporting Jew haters that set up barricades and kept the Jews out, took over the campus? No, they're going after the people that came in and tried to remove the barricades. The people that came in and said, hey, we need law and order. And this is our campus too. You can't just shut it down. And the police, as you would expect in an upside down world, the police go after the people that tried to disrupt these protests, these Jew-hating, Hamas-supporting protesters. That's, again, a pretty good sign that America is under attack from within. You see the focus of the local law enforcement over at UCLA. You see it at the DOJ. You see it in New York City. Listen to, again, this is Trump yesterday talking about the danger of this attack from within. Clip 7.
We have other politicians here. We have people, many people in support. The outside of this building is closed down like Fort Knox. Nobody's ever seen. We have so many police down here, New York's finest, and they are New York's finest. They're just told what to do, but they don't have them at Columbia. They don't have them at NYU or any other places. This is like an armed camp down here, and you have nothing to worry about. Believe me. Your problem is from the left, it's not from the right. Big problem from the left. It's from within our country. That's a bigger, in my opinion, a bigger danger than China or Russia. You have it from the outside and you have it from within. From within is a bigger danger to our country, and it's from the left, not from the right.
And it's the very same point that Dinesh D'Souza made earlier this week when we sat down with him. You know, drawing the distinction between Reagan and Trump. Reagan, you know, he was concerned about enemies on the outside. Trump, he sees that the enemy, the most dangerous one anyway, is operating from within. And that's why these kangaroo courts are being set up. That's why you see lawfare like you would see in some banana republic. It's because of this assault on America, this attack on America. The former president had some things to say about what Biden did this week to Israel, stabbing Israel in the back. Listen to clip 6.
What Biden is doing with respect to Israel is disgraceful. If any Jewish person voted for Joe Biden, they should be ashamed of themselves. He's totally abandoned Israel. And nobody can believe it. I guess he feels good about it because he did it as a political decision. You have to do the right decision, not the political decision. But he did a very bad thing.
You're really seeing Joe Obama's true colors with respect to the Jew hatred, stabbing Israel in the back. And again, we've made this point before, too, that what happened in 2020, as unjust and lawless as it was, the election steal, and then all the lies and the deception about January 6th, look at how much has been exposed regarding the radical left and their attack on America. And now you see the dear leader's true colors with respect to Israel. He came in with smooth-sounding words, but like Dinesh D'Souza pointed out, the words didn't match with his actions. And of course, the Bible tells us that we need to judge by the fruits. Well, now we're seeing the fruits and the words. I mean, they're taking the mask off. We don't want to help Israel. We're not going to do it unless they stop this attack on Hamas. This is from Brendan O'Neill over at Spike that says, imagine if in 2017 the world told the Kurds to hold off from attacking Raqqa. Imagine if, following their valiant liberation of 2,000 square miles of Syrian territory from the barbaric diktat of the Islamic State, the Kurdish-led forces were told to down arms. You know, stand down. Don't go after the Islamic State. Don't go after ISIS. It says to leave Raqqa be, to leave intact the capital of the cruelest pseudo-state the modern world has known. We would have looked upon such a request as lunacy. There's no way we would have done that or even thought to do that. It says we might even have considered it essentially pro-ISIS, a pro-ISIS position. After all, the flip side of telling the enemies of ISIS to cease fire is that ISIS would gain the breathing space to regroup, rearm, and revisit its apocalyptic sadism on the people of Syria and beyond. So it was a no-brainer, right? You've got to crush ISIS. You've got to crush these barbarians. O'Neill says here, well, just an unhinged demand is being made right now, though, of Israel, not the Kurds. It says, from the White House to those whiffy tents on campus lawns, from the leader pages of the liberal press to the Islamophobic pulpits of social media, the cry goes out, don't attack Rafah. If Israeli forces launch an investigation of that southern Gazan city in pursuit of Hamas, it will be a bloodbath, the posing peaceniks cry. It would be genocide in action. If you do it, President Biden warns Israel, we will stop providing you with certain weapons. In short, leave Rafah be, which means leave Hamas be. Let Hamas survive. You know, the butchers who attacked Israel, who invaded Israel on October 7th. O'Neill says, Biden's intervention is the most striking and unforgivable. He has threatened to deprive Israel of certain military hardware if they go into Rafah. Biden's Rafah warnings speak to the moral decay and geopolitical idiocy of his administration. Consider this. Among the Israeli hostages still held by Hamas and Islamic Jihad, 5 are American citizens. So they've still got 5 American hostages. And they're probably somewhere, if they're still alive, they're probably somewhere in Rafah. And try to wrap your mind around this if you can. Joe Obama is telling Israel to hold off, to stand down, to not go into Rafah and clear out Hamas, and to get those hostages, American hostages, in the case of 5 of them. Upside down world. You see the attack now. I mean, the masks are off. As I just said, their true colors are fully revealed. It's possible, likely even, that these Americans who languish in barbarous captivity are inside Rafah. It's extraordinary that the American president would openly threaten the army that's committed to liberating those Americans. Does this make sense? None of it makes sense. unless you understand, like Dinesh D'Souza brings out in his 2010 book, unless you understand the roots of Obama's rage, the roots of his hatred, they run deep. And we have a lot to say about it right here in this book as well. This first came out in 2013. And we talked a lot about the content of this in our interview with Dinesh D'Souza earlier this week. We've got another segment from his Sunday evening lecture queued up just in case we can squeeze in a little bit more on today's show. But coming back to this piece by Brendan O'Neill, it says, "What a gutless abdication of moral responsibility and of the national interest itself. And for what? For the fleeting thrill of an electoral boost. Biden is clearly troubled by the student protests and by predictions that he might lose the backing of progressives and some Muslim voters over his Israel stance. So he sacrifices an ally and literal American citizens at the altar of a few more ballots." He's got to get those radicals, those radical progressives setting up tent cities on campuses around the country. He's got to get the Muslims in Dearborn, Michigan to vote for him so he can win a swing state. And so what is he willing to do? He's willing to sacrifice a U.S. ally, our longstanding ally in the Middle East, our brothers, if you know anything about Bible prophecy, our brothers, or Bible history, both. He's sacrificing Israel, and in a literal sense, he's sacrificing American hostages as well. You know, the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, who's proving himself to be not so MAGA more and more as he compromises with these people. He had an interview with Politico, one of the podcasts at Politico, where he talked about working with the Biden administration and just how stunned and how betrayed he was when Biden went after Israel, when Biden stabbed Israel in the back, when Biden withdrew that support, that military support from Israel. Listen to this and just see how revealing this exchange is. This is the House Speaker. He's a Republican. He's a Republican. He's even gotten the support of Donald Trump to some degree. But here he is talking about what Joe Obama's done to Israel. Clip 11.
I want to ask you about President Biden's interview with CNN. He told CNN that if Israel invades Rafah, the U.S. will stop supplying it with artillery shells and other offensive weapons. His quote was, "If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons." Very, very clear. I know you sent a letter about this. What's your view of that?
I was informed about that statement about 10 minutes before I walked in this room, and my reaction honestly was, wow, that is a complete turn from what I had been told even in, you know, recent hours. I mean, 24 hours ago, it was confirmed to me by top administration officials that the policy is very different than what he stated there. So I hope that's a senior moment.
Wait, can you just explain that, the difference there?
I was in the skiff having classified discussions with some top administration officials. My concern, I can tell you the subject matter, my concern was we got word about these, this shipment of munitions being delayed. And that was a great concern to us because I got commitments from top administration officials before we passed the supplemental package for the aid to Israel that would not happen. And there would be no delay whatsoever. They repeated to me in writing and verbally, no delay in the delivery of weapons to Israel because it's so desperately needed. And then I went straight to the White House and I said, what gives? Somebody's going to have to explain this to me because it's very different than what I was told. And they said, oh, this has nothing to do with the supplemental package that you all passed. This is earlier weapons tranches. Well, Israel needs it right now. Well, we're working on that. Well, you better work on it quickly. So this statement by the president, I believe he's off script. I don't think that's something that staff told him to say. I hope it's a senior moment because that would be a great deviation in what is said to be the policy there and in the very critical relationship we have with Israel. This is really, that's really, really big news.
Do you feel betrayed by this then?
I got to say that I do. Yeah. I mean, we've been very deliberate. We've been very open, very much in good faith. Congress expressed its will through that vote. And so for the administration to make such a huge deviation in policy without, you know, any consultation with us, and in defiance of what we quite literally just voted on here days ago, to me, it raises a lot of alarm.
So weak, so pathetic. I mean, there he is. He's shocked. He's shocked that Joe Obama would lie. And that's all that they do. He feels betrayed. He hopes it's a senior moment from Joe Biden. Surely they can't stab Israel in the back. Sure, I mean, I got commitments. They gave me commitments. They said they were going to support Israel. And now they're not doing it so much, are they? It's astounding to me that he's so shocked that he's, I walked right over to the White House. I said, hey, what gives? He's one of many in the D.C. swamp who feels like, look, if we can just sit down and work with these people, we can come to some kind of bipartisan arrangement, some kind of agreement. There was I didn't pull this particular clip, but it was Fox News this morning commenting on a New York Post article saying that in that 17-minute interview that Joe Biden had with CNN the other day, he lied 15 times. 15! That's a lie per minute, almost. Listen to ABC as it facts check. We played the clip for you the other day. Remember how Biden said, I came into office, inflation was at 9%. Look at how much I've reduced it. And here's ABC for its part, fact-checking the fake president, clip 9.
It was 9% when I came to office. 9%.
Inflation was actually 1.4% when Biden was sworn in, peaking at 9.1% in June 2022. It has since come down to 3.5%, preventing a further drop in housing costs. In New York City, one survey found rent is rising 7 times faster than wages. In California, a condo in West Hollywood just sold for a record-smashing $24 million. Food costs also playing a role. Grocery prices are up 26% since 2019. And fast food prices are up 33%. Many consumers saying enough is enough.
But he just lies. He just lies and says, hey, the economy's never been better. I inherited 9% inflation. Now ABC says, no, actually it was 1.4%. It was unbelievably low when you came into office. But he lies 15 times, at least, according to the New York Post, in 17 minutes. How do you work with these people? Well, I guess if you want to, like Mike Johnson does, you can compromise with these people attacking the United States of America from within. Fundamental transformation. This is from that political story on Johnson. Johnson is enjoying a period of renewed respect. If Politico says you're enjoying a period of renewed respect from the regime, that's a sign that you're surrendering. You're surrendering. That's what Democrats expect always. They're not interested in bipartisan compromise that you meet in the middle with. It says here, particularly after avoiding a shutdown and pushing through aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, most House Republicans are now more frustrated with far-right members who make Johnson's life difficult than they are with Johnson. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene led the effort to try to carry out that motion to vacate, but she didn't have enough support from Republicans. let me just read it. It says here, a few hours after Representative Taylor Greene's attempt to oust him was easily defeated, Johnson sat down for an interview with the Deep Dive podcast in the speaker's suite, where he sat under a painting of his idol Ronald Reagan and answered questions for over an hour. Johnson said he would not try to defund the office of special counsel Jack Smith as sought by Greene. So he's not going to defund Jack, you know, the deranged Jack Smith that's trying to destroy Donald Trump, that's trying to throw him in prison on nothing. And they can't even defund that corruption. I mean, that's crazy. Let me just back up. It says here, most House Republicans are now more frustrated with far-right members who make Johnson's life difficult than they are with Johnson. Democrats rewarded him for his streak of responsible governing by saving him from a motion to vacate. He was saved from this effort led by Marjorie Taylor Greene. He was saved by Nancy Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries and Jerry Nadler. That's who rescued him. Why would they rescue him? Because he's perfect. They love working with rhinos who surrender. Surrender on Ukraine, surrender, surrender, surrender. I mean, even this thing with Israel. Steve Scalise was on TV this morning saying, hey, we might actually come out with articles of impeachment over the stabbing Israel in the back. Oh, really? Finally? Finally, something. Here there's proof of all this corruption, this lawlessness. And Israel, I guess, I mean, that finally has really infuriated some few Republicans. They probably won't go forward even with that. Won't defund Jack Smith and all of his corrupt prosecutors at the DOJ. Listen to this from Fox News reporting on this Missouri probe into the Joe Obama coordinated attacks on Trump. Clip 5.
The Missouri Attorney General has launched a probe into the communications between the DOJ and the prosecutors targeting former President Trump. Here is Andrew Bailey explaining his investigation. Listen.
We have every reason to believe that this is a coordinated political attack emanating from Biden's corrupt Department of Justice. We knew that the cases themselves were illicit witch hunt prosecutions, but now we have every reason to believe that the prosecutors themselves are illicitly motivated as well. We want records between Jack Smith, the Department of Justice, Alvin Bragg, Matthew Colangelo, Fannie Willis. We need to lay it all on the table so that the public can understand the illicit motivations of the prosecutors themselves.
It's all coordinated by the White House, as President Trump keeps pointing out, and all fully funded by the members of Congress, the House of Representatives, even the Republicans. This political story, it says, and then with regard to defunding Jack Smith, look, they're quoting Mike Johnson. I think that there's been a terrible dereliction of duty with regard to the special counsel and how the whole system has been abused, and how they've engaged in lawfare against President Trump. All of these things are, to me, self-evident truths. It sounds pretty, I mean, that's a strongly worded statement coming from Mike Johnson. And it's followed with this. But that's not something you wave a wand and just eliminate the special counsel as a provision. It's been part of the law, you know, the tradition and the law for 25 years. We can't do away with tradition. We can't defund these criminal actors. We've got to keep funding it. I know there's some serious abuses going on, but hey, we can't break with tradition. Listen, I'm able to sit down with Nancy Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries. I'll waltz right over to the White House and say, hey, what gives? What get? That's not what you told me the other day. It's so weak. It really is so weak and pathetic. You can't compromise with these individuals that are attacking the country from within and have vowed to fundamentally transform the United States. Here they are, just openly now, openly stabbing Israel in the back. Yeah, lying twice. I came in, I inherited 9% inflation. 9%, he said a second time. A total lie. That's what they do, though, as a matter of routine. They're quite good at it. And the lies are becoming more bold and more audacious because they're never, ever held to account. Their feet are not held to the fire. Instead, there's plenty of good Republicans, good old Republicans, that are ready to sit down and compromise with the other side. And by that, as I said earlier, it just means surrender. They surrender. And then they get a nice puff piece about them at Politico. Politico says, you know what? We're starting to gain some respect for the new House Speaker. And then the Democrats in the House say, you know what? We're going to defend this man and keep him in his position, even though he hasn't followed through in his promises to the Republicans. But look, we'll defend him. We'll keep him where he is. We're getting everything that we want. When we come back, we'll get to, I think we'll have time for this week's edition of World Watch, and then also a few more minutes from Dinesh D'Souza's address at Armstrong Auditorium on Sunday evening. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com.
Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered drills with tactical nuclear weapons in response to provocative statements and threats of certain Western officials regarding the Russian Federation, the Defense Ministry stated on May 6. This is Russia's first public announcement of drills involving tactical nuclear weapons. The order came after French President Emmanuel Macron said last week that France would consider sending ground troops to Ukraine. A day later, United Kingdom Foreign Secretary David Cameron said Ukraine could use British weapons against Russian targets. Russia's statement also came right before Putin's inauguration on May 7th, followed by the annual Victory Day celebration on May 9th that commemorates the Soviet victory in World War II. Since Russia's full-scale war against Ukraine began in 2022, it has repeatedly threatened nuclear war if the West continues providing Ukraine with weapons. These nuclear drills show that Putin remains fiercely determined to deter the West and carry out his plans in Ukraine and beyond. To learn more about the importance of the war in Ukraine and how it connects to Bible prophecy, read The Ukraine War Will Not Start World War III. China State Shipbuilding Corporation signed the largest shipbuilding deal in history with Qatar Energy on Monday. China will sell Qatar 18 liquefied natural gas ships of unprecedented size. The approximately $6 billion deal will create the largest liquefied natural gas ships in history, about 57% larger than conventional natural gas carriers. This landmark deal illustrates a shift in global power from the United States and United Kingdom to China. Historically, global superiority has depended on naval dominance. The fact that countries are looking to China in this area shows it is overtaking the formerly preeminent English-speaking nations. To learn more about why the U.S. and Britain are losing their international dominance, read The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. Houthi drones hit a Portuguese-flagged container ship in the Arabian Sea, some 375 miles off the coast of Yemen on April 26th. It appears to be the Houthis' first blue water attack since they began targeting ships in the region in November. The Houthi terrorist group does not have a proper naval fleet and is not known to have the sophisticated technology required to operate long-distance drones. Carrying out an attack in the open ocean so far from the Yemeni coast could indicate a significant upgrade of Houthi military capabilities. This would likely be due to the Houthis' main sponsor, Iran, giving the terrorist group more advanced weaponry. The development also suggests the group might be able to hit targets in more remote parts of the Indian Ocean. Conditions in the Red Sea are becoming more volatile. Iran is stirring the pot and destabilizing the region through proxies such as the Houthis. The Red Sea crisis plays a key role in end time prophecy about the King of the South. To learn more, read, "Is the Red Sea Crisis About to Fulfill Bible Prophecy?" To learn more about current world news and how it relates to Bible prophecy, please visit thetrumpet.com.
Yes, indeed. All the material that we offer on this program is available at the website, thetrumpet.com. And you can also get to these programs, My Father's Show, The Key of David. So you can order online, or you can call our operators today and request America Under Attack or anything else that we plug along the way. So there's your latest installment of World Watch. And now we'll finish today's show with another excerpt from Dinesh D'Souza's address in Armstrong Auditorium this past Sunday evening.
Great. Think of it this way. I'm on the left. Let's try to pack the court. The court has 9 people. Let's put 4 more guys on there. We'll have an immediate majority for the Democrats. Now, normally, if somebody gets the idea of packing the court, they have to worry a little bit. What if the Republicans win the next election? They could pack the court. So the aggression of packing the court on the side of the Democrats is tempered by the fear that the Republicans could do the same. In fact, the Republicans could do more. Okay, they put 4 guys on the court. We win the White House and the Senate. We put 17 guys on the court on the other side. However, the Democrats know that we are too stupid to do that. We are committed to 9. Even though 9 is nowhere in the Constitution, there's no requirement it be 9. Because of tradition and because we are people of principle, it's got to be 9. So if the Democrats make it 13, let's try to go back to 9. Though great, even if we lose, even if their effort fails, the other guys won't do anything, and then we try again. That's their strategy. And similarly, let's use the weaponry of the government to go after those guys. Why? Because we know they'll never do it to us. Bill Barr was going before the Senate when he was Attorney General and boasting, name a single Democrat, not even that I've indicted, that I've even investigated. Apparently the answer was 0. So the Democrats go, wonderful. We'll grab their filmmaker, Dinesh, and stick him in jail. We know the Republicans will never go after Michael Moore. They'll never go after Rosie O'Donnell. Why? Because they don't want to single them out. They're people of principle. They don't want to engage in political persecution. So there is an imbalance, I think, is what I'm trying to say. And it continues even at the small level and in tiny things. So right now, let's take social media. If tonight I go to my hotel and I say, oh, I gave a wonderful talk, the audience was great, I show a picture, within about 5 minutes, there will be 10 attacks on me. And attacks on you, by the way. They will try to humiliate me. It's not they disagree with me, oh, Dinesh, let's listen to what you said, we have a critique. No, they don't care about a critique. Their stuff is stuff like, look at those old white people in the audience. I don't see any black people. I mean, it's not true, but that's what they'll say. They'll attack me, and they'll try to disgrace me. Their idea is to drive me out of public life. That's their motive. They want me to say, oh man, Dinesh, you're doing well, you don't ever have to work. You don't need it, man, why are you doing this? Part of what they don't understand about Trump is the same thing. The guy's a billionaire. He could be on an island. But what the heck is he doing running for president? He's 91 indictments. He doesn't care. Taking on Trump is like wrestling with a pig, because not only does it get everyone dirty, but the pig seems to like it. They can't figure the guy out. And the same with me. So on social media, back to my example, this is what they do. This is not what we do. If Nancy Pelosi goes on social media and posts something, you think that there are people on our side who go on there and go, vodka Nancy. How come your grandchildren are so ugly? What was your husband doing in his underpants? Did the other guy show up in his underpants also? What was that all about? But what I'm getting at is, we don't think like that. I mean, I do, but mostly we don't. We don't think like that. And so again, there is a imbalance in the political structure. Our side does not go to it with the same naked ruthlessness of the other side. And this poses a problem. Now, I'll give an example from Lincoln and then say a word about the American founding, because the Lincoln example to me is very illuminating. So Abraham Lincoln, in the early years of the war, began for the first time to deploy black troops in the Union Army. Not a lot. The Civil War was for the main, in the main, a white man's fight. But nevertheless, there was a black regiment, and there were some black troops, and if you saw the movie Glory, it dramatizes that episode, that regiment. But the Confederates were so outraged at the idea of fighting against black troops that they immediately passed an edict signed by Jefferson Davis: any black Union soldier captured by the Confederates will be immediately executed. And this comes to the attention of Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln, in a scene that I actually dramatized in one of my films, you see Lincoln, he's getting on a train, he's kind of enveloped in smoke, and he is signing what historians now call the Order of Retaliation. Order of Retaliation, 1863. For every black Union soldier captured and executed by the Confederacy, one Confederate captive will be shot. Now, why would Lincoln, a moderate man, issue an order of such barbarity? An order that today would violate the laws of war, the Geneva Convention. But Lincoln's view is really simple. We have to do to them what they are doing to us, or they will never stop. And in fact, shortly after Lincoln issued the order, the Confederates withdrew theirs, to which Lincoln withdrew his. And this, I think, is not only an example from the founder, by the way, of the Republican Party, but it illustrates a key point about the American founding. Namely, that the whole point of the American founding is not to give us what can be called parchment protection for anything, because the Constitution cannot do that. A document that writes, Congress shall pass no law restricting freedom of speech or of the press, is worthless if the people living under that document ignore it. If they find rights that are not in the Constitution and take away rights that are in there. So what is the founder's answer to that? Well, the founder's answer to that is actually something that is not in the Constitution, but is the underpinning of the whole constitutional architecture of separation of powers, checks and balances. What is the point of any of that? What is the rationale for it? Why is that important to do? Well, the answer is that in a democratic society, you have majorities, you have minorities, and you actually want both sides to be a little scared of the other. Majorities need to be a little scared that if they tick off the minorities too much, the minorities might go insane. And that won't be good for the majority. So that tempers the majority. Don't go too far, because the other side can only take so much. And conversely, the minority has got to recognize that the majority can rule, but again, up to a point. You cannot antagonize the majority beyond a point, because they do have democratic legitimacy. They do have a right to rule, but they don't have a right to run roughshod over your rights. There's a very interesting section in Lincoln's first inaugural where he is making the case against secession. And his case against secession is actually pretty persuasive. Lincoln basically says, listen, the reason you want to break up the country is because you lost a free and fair election. You're not even contesting the election. You admit I won. But you still want to break up the country. You can't have a democracy where if you lose, you break up the country. That's just never going to work. But interestingly, if you read that speech carefully, it contains a reversal. In fact, all good speeches do. They, by spelling out reasons why you can't secede, it leaves open the door, are there some conditions in which you can secede? And Lincoln says this. He says, now admittedly, if I were elected and I began to run roughshod over your rights, I began to suppress your right to speak, suppress your right to vote, suppress the basic rights laid out in the Bill of Rights, Lincoln implies, although he doesn't say, you would have every right to secede. But Lincoln's point is, I haven't done those things. I've just been elected. You're seceding before I've even taken office. I have not run roughshod over your rights. But the truth in America today is our rights are being trampled on. And the beginning of political wisdom is to recognize it's happening, it can't be denied, and we need to do something about it. The reason I made the film Police State is because it's very difficult for the ordinary American to grasp that this can happen to you. You think it's gonna have to happen to someone else. This is our natural human tendency to go into denial. Solzhenitsyn says in the opening pages of the Gulag that even when the Soviet soldiers came to arrest people on the orders of Stalin, they had long lists of people, just arrest these people. People, whenever they came to your door, they were always like, oh, there's got to be some mistake. Why me? There must be some misunderstanding. And so Solzhenitsyn says that the guy being arrested, instead of paying attention to what are the few things that I can do to get out of this, such as scream my head off and hope my neighbors show up and the cops get scared and they leave and I get the heck out of town. That might work. I'm not saying it's going to work, but it might work. Instead of that, you engage in this absurd, let me try to clear up the matter right now. The guy who has your name on a list, they don't even know who you are. They have no explanation to give you about why they're arresting you. All this talk about why me is utterly beside the point. The point is screaming, resisting, jumping out of windows. Those are your actual options. But most of us are in denial until it happens to you. And then you can't believe that it's happening in America. But you still have trouble convincing anybody else because it hasn't happened to them. So the point of a movie, which is different, and this is kind of also why, you know, I could write about it. I can tell you about it. I can give you an experience on my podcast. But a movie can show you. So one of these guys, for example, who got arrested, who's in Police State, He's a high-tech guy. And what does he do? He installs all these surveillance devices in his apartment. Now, the beauty of this is that you can see the FBI coming running up the front door, running up the stairs, all in weaponry, heavy armor, machine guns all drawn, long guns. They whip out a big piece of tape and they cover his peephole because they think it might be a camera. Now, think about it. If they're legit, why would they do that? They're trying to hide the evidence. What they don't know is he has other cameras in the apartment. So if you watch the movie, you're seeing the actual footage of the FBI raid from inside the apartment. And it is, I mean, that apartment looks like Gaza, you know, when they're done. And this is all happening to ordinary people, not just Trump, in America now. So we need ways to counter all this. And some of it, of course, is winning the White House. And that's dealing with the issue of election fraud and all the other stuff that goes along with it. When I made 2,000 Mules, my biggest problem wasn't really the left. In fact, people on the left would see the movie and go, whoa. My biggest problem were know-it-all conservatives and terrified Republicans. So let's start with the know-it-all conservatives. They're like, well, Dinesh, you're showing me mules and their cell phones, have them going to one Dropbox and the next Dropbox and the next Dropbox and the next Dropbox, but you only have video of the guy in one Dropbox. To which my answer is that very little surveillance video was even done. Even in the places that did it, out of 10 Dropboxes, they put surveillance on one Dropbox. So it's kind of like this. You have a serial killer who went to 10 different homes, let's just say over the course of a week, in the middle of the night, killed 10 people, the bodies are in the homes. You check his cell phone, it shows him moving from one house to the next house to the next house, but only home number 4 has a camera. But you happen to know from the cell phone data that he arrived at that home on Tuesday night at 2 a.m. in the morning. And so you go to the surveillance camera to that exact day and that exact time, and you turn on the camera, and boom, there he is coming through the door. Now, if you're on the jury, do you convict or not? Now, if you're Ben Shapiro, you go, I cannot convict, because although I see him in home number 4, where is he on the video camera in homes number 1, 2, 3, 5? And my answer is, there were no cameras in those homes. That was a violation of the election law. There should have been, but there weren't. But if his phone puts him at all these places, and in the one place where there was a camera, there's a complete corroboration between the camera and the surveillance and the phone, case closed as far as I can see. This is the problem with the know-it-all concern. This is, think of it, on the left, whenever they put forward a theory, do other leftists show up to debunk it? Never. On our side, everybody wants to show, I'm smarter than Dinesh. I'm going to expose a flaw in his movie.